From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in June 1999. That was when a file-sharing online site called Napster was launched. For college students especially, it was a bonanza, a way to get and share music for free. All of a sudden, music customers didn't have to purchase CDs. They could download whatever they wanted. And yes, some computers took hours to download a single song, but that didn't stop millions from doing it. Well, start it with Metallica. They didn't like it, nor did many other music stars. They spoke out, then Dr. Dre did as well. Lawsuits were filed, recording companies sued Napster, and in college dorm rooms, the rumors flew. If you still use Napster, the feds would come after you. I remember being warned about it specifically. So Napster essentially shuts down, but its descendants are certainly with us today. You can get music for free through, say, Spotify. YouTube is an oasis of free music, old music videos, and more. All of this just a taste of why making a living is more challenging for musicians and bands who want to break through and continue to do it for a living. Now, earlier this month, megastar Taylor Swift wrote an essay in the Wall Street Journal. She argued that while album sales have plummeted, there's a bright future for bands. Swift argued that too often musicians give in and give away their music for free. So we wanted to convene a musicians' roundtable to explore these issues and more, asking how bands can make a living in the online era. Joining us for the roundtable, and this is a great panel, we've got Mikey James from Admirers, but Mikey, as we've established, get a little closer to the mic. You're a recording guy, you know.
Yeah, sure.
To see you.
I didn't know if you were going to address me yet.
There you are. So Mikey's with Admirers now, but you have a sort of a long history with music in Rochester.
Yeah, well, I started with a band called Long Wave, I suppose, but I had to move to New York to get any sort of notoriety, I suppose. And then after we got dropped, I moved back. Took a couple years to get a new band together. I put out a record called The Mercies, and then we broke up 2 months after that came out. And then I eschewed bands altogether and then just went solo and did Mikey Jukebox. And then I just started Admirers, too. I don't know.
So now you'll find them in Admirers.
It's like a Bowie fetish, and Roy will help you out with that. It's an identity crisis, I suppose.
This hour could be become behind the music. It really could be, really. Kat Bowers here from Water Street Music Hall, and Kat has been working with me in the last week to sort through the so many. Kat, there are so many great folks who could have been in on this panel today.
There are. We went through a long list, and I'm really glad to see who we've got here because I've run into old friends who I haven't seen and met some new people that I've wanted to meet in person.
Absolutely. Roy Stein from My Plastic Son is here. Roy is also, Roy teaches a music business program at Nazareth. So you've been around, you teach, and you do it.
Yeah, I direct the music business program at Nazareth College. And I've been playing since 72 in groups, in Rochester. I was in New Math, which was on CBS Records, Jet Blackberry's on Enigma. This would be late 70s, early 80s. Played with the Atomic Swindlers, and most recently, My Plastic Son.
And Mike Muscarella is here. Mike is with Violet Mary. Mike, nice to see you.
Good afternoon.
Thanks for being here. On the phone with us is Matt Merritt from Roses and Revolutions. Matt, where are you? Are you on the way to a far-flung gig somewhere?
Yes, we're on the road to New York City right now. So.
Well, thanks for taking the time and being on the phone with us. We appreciate your time as well.
Oh, thank you for having me.
I would be remiss if we didn't at least hear some of the music for some of the folks on the panel. So we might as well kick it off with a clip from Violet Mary. This is a tune called With the Sun.
Mm-hmm.
From what album?
It's from the Level album from 2012.
All right. Let's listen to Violet Mary as we start our panel. That's Violet Mary, Wake Up With The Sun. That's a beautiful chorus. Beautiful song, Mike. And you happen to know the lead singer there pretty well.
Pretty well, yes. I have seen where she sleeps. That's my wife, Mel, who's our lead vocalist.
Great vocalist.
Oh, she's She's incredible. She spoils the band rotten.
Now, let's start with a little bit of the Violet Mary backstory.
Sure.
Give me a sense for where you stand in terms of the music world, and what's a week of Violet Mary like?
Well, we have intentional hot and cold seasons. So ironically, the cold seasons are during the cold season. A normal week for us in the summer would be weekly rehearsals and usually a gig on Friday or Saturday night. We tend to be pretty busy weekly between March and November.
It's a strange question, but what's the ultimate goal?
The ultimate goal is to make music pay for itself at the end of the day. We started out very intentionally, and I think that's probably going to be mentioned multiple times today. We started out with a really intentional goal. Our goal is to make music pay for itself and to make music we love. And neither of those are things we're going to compromise.
How close are you to being able to do that?
Oh, we function in the black all the time.
All right.
That is intentional. But we also don't ask for anything from the band. The band doesn't ask for anything from us, and we don't ask from the band, which allows us to do things like be really selective about what we play, where we play, how we play. We produce our own records, and that means that we can do whatever we want.
It's interesting. Mike, I had a conversation with him on Friday as we got ready for this panel, and you have a sort of this intellectual approach to this. That it's very thoughtful. I think you know, frankly, a lot of bands could benefit from that kind of intellectual approach to what your expectations are and how to make it work. But you also made the point that as much as we may be somewhat, and we're going to get into the Spotify's of the world, the Pandora's, mm-hmm. the impact, as much as we may be pessimistic about that, we're not that long into human history of actually being able to get paid for art.
Well, my day job, I'm a global history teacher, so my head's always in that world. But this idea of a superstar or of a Taylor Swift is a relatively new invention of modern culture. You know, this is a post-Elvis world, and we tend to think of things within this very fixed worldview of this is what modern culture is, and that's all that we know. But music has been around since people gathered together around fire, and people were writing fabulous music in the 1500s and 1600s because it was something they had to do. It was a vital behavior of theirs, not because they could crack 100,000 records. Nobody cared.
Yeah, the French troubadours.
But,
sure.
But Mozart, Beethoven, the great classical writers were very interested in being paid well.
They were.
And being supported by the King's Court or whomever they were in consignment with.
They were. But at the same time that Mozart and Beethoven are creating music, there are hundreds of other musicians creating equally as high-caliber music.
Perhaps we're talking about the incentive as where, like, Bach and Mozart, they were going to do it no matter what,
exactly.
Paid or no paid, perhaps. But maybe the way the kids grow up now, it's like, I want to be that.
Yeah.
And then they work towards it. Maybe it's not always
it's a little
genius
bit like
rising
the,
to the...
It's a little bit like the NFL from the previous segment. Are you going to school so that you can get into the NFL, or are you going to school so that you can get an education?
Yep.
And I love the NFL.
Yeah.
But I think it differs in each hemisphere, though, because
absolutely.
I don't think the English are like that as much. I think they're more about the art. It's all those great bands from the 60s, right? They were all art school kids. As we're over here, it's like super commodity.
Well, and we may be getting a little far afield. But
here we go.
And we're off. Yeah.
But I think that's part of the point of the panel. And Beethoven died in squalid conditions. Now, part of that might have been due to his obstreperous nature with his fellow human beings. But anyway, the bottom line, I think that Mike was raising the point, is that you're not terribly pessimistic about this notion of making a living in music or making money from your art.
I love it. There's nothing pessimistic about it, because in so many ways, Violet Mary has set itself up to create its own reality. We do what we want and we don't do what we don't want. And so music is pure joy all the time.
Yeah.
Even when it's the knocking on venues' doors, or even when it is trying to convince a promoter that selling 100 tickets for the headliner at $30 a piece, but we have to front all of that money first, convincing them that it's ridiculous is a nightmare and a headache and frustrating. But at the same time, the way we've set up our business model, if I don't convince them, fine, I don't care. We'll just find something else. We'll do something else.
Let me turn to Roy Stein from My Plastic Son, and let's listen to a clip from My Plastic Son. We've got Give It All Away, if that's all right with you.
That's fine.
All right, let's listen to a clip. This is My Plastic Son. That's My Plastic Son, Give It All Away. I am always hesitant to make comparisons because in some way that might minimize the individualism of a band, but I can easily think of some big, big acts out there, the Radioheads and the Coldplays of the world that sound evokes, and it's beautiful.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I mean, I don't mind comparisons at all. I think it's an easy way for consumers especially to get a handle on, okay, I like this band.
Yeah.
Who's like, it's the Pandora model, so I have no problem with that. As long as the comparisons are Coldplay and Radiohead, you go right ahead. Come on.
You picked a couple, yeah. No, but that's genuinely what comes to mind. Now, you not only teach on music business, but you've been in the industry and seen what the industry looks like for artists for decades now, Roy. So what are the biggest changes that you've seen?
Well, the biggest changes are obvious. I mean, the biggest changes is the ability to... you know, it's what technology has done in terms of streaming music and your ability to grab music from the internet. Also, the ability for artists to record at a fraction of the cost, you know, record quality material. It used to cost, I mean, really seriously, at least a couple $100,000 to do a record that could compete on a national level. Now you can do that for $4,000, $5,000, $6,000, $10,000.
Yeah, this actually kind of... I want to divert the conversation because Roy's point there, I think, is an important one. And so, it's easier than ever to record music. I don't know if GarageBand is even still around.
GarageBand is around, and it's a fine format. But you can get into very sophisticated recording software with advanced plugins for
a few thousand dollars. That's not $100,000 like it used to.
Exactly. It's a few thousand dollars.
Yeah, so I have someone very close to me who helped to produce a record for an eighth grade girl. He was hired to help her learn to write music. She's very talented. So he gets hired as sort of a songwriting coach. And he was calling me saying, boy, she's so talented. She's great. And in the past, that would have been as far as it goes. He helps her play guitar, maybe write some lyrics, put stuff to music. But now, all of a sudden, they start talking about, well, you know, we've got some friends who can play this and that. And they end up recording together. They started recording demos on cell phones, sending them to each other on cell phones, and then the next thing you know, they're getting together in a studio for rather minimal cost compared to what it used to be, Roy.
Right.
She's barely 14 years old. Her name's Drew Kayla. All of a sudden now her album is on iTunes, and I'd like to listen to a clip of her song Graduation Day. This is Drew Kayla, barely 14 years old, and this is the kind of thing that you never know could end up going viral. Take all my little fears, all my little cares, all my wishy ways. Okay, so 14 years old, and again, 20 years ago, that would have never gone anywhere. Now that's on iTunes, and, you know, Roy, is that an indication that, is music more meritocratic that way? Is there more opportunity to at least be heard?
Well, absolutely. I mean, the for good and for worse, radio labels were the gatekeepers. And A&R people, who were very dedicated, would go out and hear hundreds of bands, but they'd make the choice as to who got into those expensive recording studios, was surrounded by great producers, had great microphones, I mean, all this stuff. So now there are a number of places in Rochester, some of the finest studios in Rochester are home studios that I don't even know about. I hear about them occasionally, and there are people who have invested $40,000, $50,000, $100,000 in a home studio. So you can record quality material. The negative of that is that everybody's recording quality material.
Right, right. So there's
so how do you get heard through the din? How do you break through when a woman, this 14-year-old, has recorded, you know, a really nice piece of music, and there's 14-year-olds doing this all over the country.
Right.
So the challenge, as you said, how, you know, how do you go viral? How do you break out?
Yeah, and we're going to be talking about that and more coming up here. I want to keep kind of going around the table to make sure we get a taste of all of the different music acts that we have here. So, Mikey mm-hmm. James with Admirers. I've got a clip from Spirit Lamp, if that's all right with you.
Sure.
This is Admirers, and the song's called Spirit Lamp. Let's listen. And the song is called Spirit Lamp from Admirers. Now, Mikey James hasn't been in the business quite as long as Roy, but you and I talked on Friday, and you said you look at 2003 to now, 11 years, mm-hmm. huge change in the industry. How?
The lawyer we had for Longwave, her name is Rosemary Carroll, and she's the lawyer for Patti Smith and Prince and stuff, and after a couple years had gone by, and I would still use her for whatever to, you know, look over contracts and stuff. And she was like, you know what? I was thinking about it the other day, and Longwave was the last great deal I ever did. And it was almost like the end of an era.
Why was that?
I don't know. It's like the budgets you were talking about. We had the great budget. We had the advances. Mm-hmm. We had the tour bus to go play in front of 20 people in Salt Lake City. Those were, you know what I mean?
Mike and Roy are nodding like, those were the days.
We had the three RCA presidents in a year, two A&R guys. It's just, and you could tell maybe that's the shuffle was happening then, because it was a weird time. We never had any solidarity over there.
So those things exist, but for a smaller number of acts now? Is that?
Oh, they absolutely still exist. I mean, there are labels still have the power to break an act, unquestionably. Mm-hmm. But their ability to recoup on a major level is so diminished. Taylor Swift, who's, you know, one of the mega artists of the world, probably would have sold twice as many records back in 1995, mm. CDs, than she can now.
Yep. And yeah, she addressed that in her piece. Go ahead,
but
Mike.
The Green Day, 8 million in the 2 years or whatever, that's done, right?
Like,
yeah. For the most part, I think, you know, once in a while we'll have some incredible breakthrough,
yeah.
But...
We've got Matt Merritt on the phone with us again. He's from Roses and Revolutions, and we're going to listen to a clip from a song called Take Me With You, and then we'll get a chance to talk to Matt. Let's listen to Roses and Revolutions.
Jump in, try to swim, won't drown this. Jump in, singing it. Over my head so high. Got my head in the clouds. I'm going under. Make my way. Yeah. What do you do when love loses you? Give it up or keep on trying? Take me with you. Take me with you.
Great stuff, Matt Merritt. That's really good stuff to hear. You're on the road to New York City. I asked Mike Muscarella from Violet Mary the same kind of question, but give me a sense for where Roses and Revolutions is in terms of your goals in music.
We have short-term goals, we have long-term goals, and the goals change, you know, day by day, week by week, month by month. The end goal is always for us to be doing this, you know, full time as a living, which we are doing right now. Both of us, Alyssa and I, got to leave our jobs, pay our apartment, our car bills, doing music. There's always, you know, we'd be lying if we didn't say the end goal was to be playing, you know, in front of a larger audience and be known more on a, you know, more massive level. And that's our goal.
Kat Bowers here from Water Street Music Hall, and I think the Water Streets of the world, the reason I wanted Kat here, that's the kind of venue that I think is still so important that artists feel interest, that they feel a sizable venue that really champions local. Kat, what have you seen in terms of changes when it comes to the music business, and how important you think the venues like Water Street are?
Things have changed. We were talking earlier before we came in the studio, and I worked at Water Street before, and then I came back, and I've worked at other venues and for other promoters over the years. And years ago, Jeff Springen at the Creek, any local band would just be so happy to play for free, to get on a show, to play with a national act. It was the excitement of it. It was, you know, let's go play music, you know, be on the stage. And nobody ever thought about where you're going from there. It was just like, oh, we get to play on the same stage as so-and-so. Then when I was at Water Street before, it evolved in a different way. They used to have young local bands sell tickets to shows and be paid a commission on what they sold. And that worked fine, but as we all said out there, there's no way I could ask a musician at the level of any of these guys, or my example was Tommy Burnett, can I get you to sell tickets and I'll give you $2 for each ticket? No, by the way, you'll open for John Hiatt. Great, but not really going to help him in his career at all. Because to me, bands should be paid what they're worth. Our new policy is that we pay you. It's not always our choice which band goes on the show, because the national act, their management, their agent, has the final call. But what we've done since the new owner took over is change the policy a little bit. We go out of our way to find local bands. We ask, you know, on social media, do you know somebody that wants to open for so-and-so? We send the cream of the crop, or the ones that we feel are best, that fit the show the best, and they decide. And we will champion bands. We just don't want to put a band on a show because they can sell tickets.
Right.
We want to put a band on the show because they enhance the show. They belong on that show. We want them to bring their fans. We want their fans to see them. It gives them a different opportunity. And unfortunately, because we're only open when we have shows, we're not like a Loving Cup or a Bug Jar where somebody can go play every week and see you. When you do come to Water Street, you do have a little bit of a jump, so to speak, in terms of, oh, I got to play Water Street and open for so-and-so, which, again, is a great thing, but I want to see you get paid for it. So I kind of think things have evolved over the point. And now with social media, any one of these guys can sit here at the table and tell you, you know, the first thing that they do is promote themselves. And to me, that's really enhanced what they do, because there were so many bands I didn't know about before, and now I know about them because of social media.
Yeah, you know, I go back to my college days, and I'll date myself a little bit, but I was a Guster rep. And Guster, so Guster in 1995 had reps because there was no Twitter. And people did not know they were coming. My job was to make sure people knew Guster was coming to my college campus. And now, at the very least, I imagine that's changed for everyone in this panel, that at least you can promote.
Is a good analogy, you talk about you being old. We all know I'm pretty much the oldest person at this table. Well, okay, Roy, we'll fight about it later. But way back when, I worked with Little Feet, and it used to be, you know, me and my clipboard outside the venue, sign up people for a mailing list, and they would laugh at me. You know, the tour manager and the guys in the band, Kat's walking around begging people for phone numbers. Yeah. She's desperate. And it was, then all of a sudden we got email, so I stopped doing addresses and mailings. Within, I think, 18 months, we had a 20,000 person email list. Now, because of that, they generate another income. Once a year, they go to Jamaica. Fans will buy tickets to go to Jamaica and hang out with the band.
Cool.
So there are other avenues, and things have changed so much that I can't even keep up, because, you know, you talk about Napster. I remember Napster, but I also remember things long before that. You know, we'd swap cassette tapes and things like that.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm
lagging and all. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm just glad to see how things have evolved, because it gives bands a different set on how they can sell themselves. Because to me, if people don't hear you or they don't know about you, then they can't buy your music. They can't buy your T-shirt. They can't buy your keychain. They can't buy a ticket to your show.
It's our Musicians Roundtable. That's Kat Bauer from Water Street Music Hall. We also have Mike Muscarella from Violet Mary, Roy Stein from My Plastic Son, Matt Merritt on the phone with us. They're on the road, Roses and Revolutions, and Mikey James from Admirers. We're talking about making it in the music industry. This is just a small slice of the really interesting and diverse music scene in Rochester. We're thrilled they're taking the time for us with our roundtable this afternoon. Short break, and we're going to come back, and we're going to poll our panel and find out how many of them use Spotify or how many of them hate Spotify and Pandora's of the world, and whether those mechanisms are fair for musicians and how they get paid. So that's just one example. That's coming up next on Connections on member-supported public radio. I'm Evan Dawson. Tuesday on the next Connections, clear your head. When we talked about migraines on the show recently, we had a flood of questions, many that we didn't have time to address. So we've invited Dr. Catherine Levine back to answer your questions about headache, migraine, and more. And we'll explore some big news regarding the Finger Lakes wine industry. It's all coming up Tuesday on the next Connections.
As a white Texan whose great-great-grandfather owned slaves, journalist Chris Tomlinson felt a responsibility to understand what happened on his family's land. On the next Fresh Air, we talk about his new book, Tomlinson Hill, which also tells the story of the slaves who kept the name Tomlinson when they were freed. And we'll hear from one of their descendants, LeVar Tomlinson.
Here we come,
join
guys.
Us.
That's coming up tonight at 7 o'clock right here on your public radio station, WXXI and WEOS.
Welcome back. I'm Evan Dawson. It's our Connections Musicians Roundtable as we look at the world of making it in music. And I confess that it was a Taylor Swift essay in the Wall Street Journal that sparked my interest in this subject. She wrote a couple weeks ago, and I want to quote from her essay. Quote, there are many, many people who predict the downfall of music sales and the irrelevancy of the album as an economic entity. I am not one of them. In my opinion, the value of an album is and will continue to be based on the amount of heart and soul an artist has bled into a body of work and the financial value that artists and their labels place on their music when it goes out into the marketplace. Piracy, file sharing, and streaming have shrunk the numbers of paid album sales drastically, and every artist has handled this blow differently. So, I was thinking about Spotify, for example. So, a couple of points on that. Radiohead's frontman Tom York removed his solo stuff and his side project from Spotify, and he tweeted, quote, make no mistake, new artists you discover on Spotify will not get paid. Meanwhile, shareholders will shortly be rolling in it. Spotify says that's wrong. David Byrne of Talking Head says, quote, the internet will suck all creative content out of the world. In the future, if artists have to rely almost exclusively on the income from these services, they will be out of work within a year. So I asked on Twitter, do you use Spotify? And how do you feel about it? Do you feel guilty about it? Jeremy says, I don't feel guilty because the artists get paid on a per-listen basis. Tom says, yep, I use it. I don't feel guilty in the slightest. I do feel awful guilty about not riding in a horse-drawn carriage, though. Maybe saying the world has changed. Ben says, I'm a premium subscriber who purchases music that I discover through Spotify. Dave says, I use Songza more, but have been giving Spotify another chance recently. And others have said when they use Spotify, then they go out and buy the albums. So a lot of debate within the music world about something like Spotify. Let me ask the room here. We'll start with Roy.
Well,
Spotify.
Spotify, I mean, it's fantastic on some levels. Look, the money you get from Spotify in terms of the royalty statements, because you're going to be paid, you know, through BMI or ASCAP, whoever you're with, it's a fraction of a fraction of a penny.
Yeah, it's 7/100th of a cent per play.
Yeah, it's pathetic.
Per play, 7/100th of a cent?
When you're played on the radio, it's about 9 cents per play. If you're played on large internet stations, Sirius XM, and you're on one of their banner, you know, headline, you know, channels, you're looking at about 80 cents per play. So, I mean, compare, what did you say it was?
7/100th of a cent.
Right, 7/100th of a cent to 80 cents. So Spotify is not going to make you money no matter who you are as an artist. I don't care if you're a mega artist. It's just not going to be much.
Do you use Spotify?
Well, yes. I mean, it's hard to take yourself off of it. I mean, generally, I want to be on iTunes. I want to be on Spotify. I want to be on Amazon. I want to be on Pandora. I want to be everywhere the music can be heard. It would be nice to get a little bit more money from Spotify, but it's a business model, and their subscribers aren't paying a great deal of money. So Mike, it is what it is.
Mikey, do you get checks for fractions of a cent?
Yeah, I got a $20 check from Spotify.
So, okay, well.
I mean, I think, I don't know how long the period was or whatever. It's probably a couple of years, but I don't know. I mean, I use it every day. And I have a one-year-old daughter, and she's obsessed with Jimmy Cliff. And where I take her down on the canal, and I'm walking her, and it's great. I just throw it on, and we're walking in the sun
and listening
to Jimmy
Cliff. You don't feel guilt about it then?
Not really. I mean, I think those guys, you know, you brought up Tom York and David Byrne, and they knew the glory days. They knew how you could, I don't know if that was gouging back then. I don't know what was going on, but.
So the horse-drawn your perspective carriage, is different because you weren't a part of those days.
It's good and bad. It's like with anything, you know. I mean,
Matt Merritt, Roses and Revolutions. Are you on Spotify? Yeah.
Yes, we're on Spotify.
Do you use Spotify yourself?
Yeah, we both use it. We use Pandora. I mean, it's one of those things that I think, like, you know, bands coming up today, like, you know, it may not be like as good as it was back then, but I don't think you can really ignore it. You know, I think you're actually hurting yourself if you choose to, you know, go against it. I mean, some of the superstars that you mentioned,
yeah,
you know, they might have the power and, you know, the credibility to take their, you know, a solo album off or whatever and just put it on maybe iTunes or just put it in stores and have people buy it. But, you know, I mean, we've had a lot of people discover us through Pandora or Spotify, and, you know, I think the benefits of that, you know, outweigh the very, very small checks that you get from it.
Yeah, Matt, I think that's a good point, and I think we're going to get to that a broadening of that theme in just a minute, the notion of the powerful artists. I'm not demeaning their point of view, but it's definitely easier for them to say, I'm right. not going to participate in that, whereas, you know, Violet Mary, are you on Spotify,
yes.
Mike? And yep. You feel like you got to be, right?
We don't have to be, but we'd be stupid not to be, because that's where people...
The majority, the kids, that's
right.
where they're going.
People, our target audience is not this 13-year-old girl who's going to listen to stuff on Spotify, but they are listening, and someone might find us there, like Matt was just saying. You know, we might be found there, and then it's a means to an end. It's an advertising stream.
Yeah, fair enough. Well, here's another, broadening on that point, here's another section of Taylor Swift's essay. I'll quote from it, and then we'll talk about this. Quote, "Music is art, and art is important and rare. Important, rare things are valuable. Valuable things should be paid for. It's my opinion that music should not be free, and my prediction is that individual artists and their labels will someday decide what an album's price point is. I hope they don't underestimate themselves or undervalue their art." On the notion of that she's making here, that's Taylor Swift again in the Wall Street Journal. On the larger point she's making is she thinks too many musicians, too many bands are too willing to say yes to give things away for free. For example, they want to put your song in an ad, a commercial, and they can't pay you or they don't want to pay you. And you say no, or you say yes to that. I mean, she's saying you got to be firmer. But again, it's easier for her. She's at the very top of the mountain, and there's My Plastic Son, Roy. I mean, if you get a call about being in a commercial, but they can't pay you, what's the conversation like?
Well, the conversation is, you know, what is the commercial? What kind of, you know, play is it going to get? The Atomic Swindlers, we haven't recorded in 10 years. I found out 2 months ago that we were on a VH1 show last fall. And it paid pretty well through BMI and ASCAP. We didn't get any licensing fee up front, no sync licensing fee up front. But so there's multiple sources of revenue. So saying one to one source doesn't mean that you're foreclosing another source. And let me just disagree with one thing Taylor Swift said. Musicians don't determine the price point for their music. The market does. Mm-hmm. You know, so I'm not really sure what she's talking about. You know, there's multiple ways to download music, and she's not going to be able to stop them. If she doesn't want to sell on Spotify and I want to get her music for free, I'll go to YouTube and use an MP3 converter. So, you know, it's somewhat of a spacious argument, I think.
Well,
she's
making two different points in the same, like she's having two different conversations in the same paragraph. Mm-hmm. She's talking about music as art and art as a cultural expression and art as rare and beautiful and awesome. And then she starts talking about economics. Mm-hmm. And they're two different questions. They're two entirely different questions.
I should tell the story, and I think it's relevant. In fact, I think I should do credit to the band. When we were getting this show started, we launched the show in January, and I wanted music for the show that I felt good about. And, you know, we've got a catalog of cuts and things like that that are sort of, you pay to use the catalog as sort of generic cuts, and et cetera, et cetera. But I heard a song by a band called Rah Rah Riot that I loved, and they've got, you know, local ties, et cetera. And that's the song you hear at the start of and close of every program here on Connections. And the song's called Shadow Casting. It's a great tune, and I'd love it if you go to iTunes and buy it for a buck or whatever it is. I mean, I'd be thrilled for the band, because I contacted the band and we did not have a budget for it. And I had to be honest with them and tell them that I want to use your music and I hope it's good for you. But I told them, I emailed through their label, Barsook, and I said, if you don't think that this is good for you, I don't even want you to consider this, because I've got brothers who've been in music and I don't want to be the guy who's cutting somebody's legs off. If you think me putting the song on the show and me mentioning Rah Rah Riot a couple thousand times a year and bringing them into the studio, which we're going to do, and my goal is to have them play that song live, if you think that's valuable, I want you to do it. But, you know, I was on that position, too, where I'm asking somebody for a song, but I can't pay you. And I hate being in that position, but, you know, I mean, that's part of the world. There's a difference, though, between that and a big company saying, hey, if our Coca-Cola ad, Mikey James, we want to use your music, and we can't pay you, but wouldn't it be nice if you just give it to us? I mean, I guess so. Every time is a little different.
Coca-Cola, like Roy said, yeah, I would do Coca-Cola, yeah. Well, because then if it gets played, you're going to get royalties.
But they should pay you. Coca-Cola
anyway.
Should pay you.
Sure, sure. And I don't know how much that's going on. Coca-Cola
right.
would pay.
They will pay. Absolutely.
So, I mean, it would be like RC Cola. No, even RC Cola would pay you. We don't know the cola company that wouldn't pay you.
Uh-oh.
It would be some Kickstarter company that yeah. wouldn't be paying you. And then it would be whether or not you're into the ethics of the deal. And I would probably say yes. You know? I don't know. I haven't had that come up yet. I usually get paid for what I'm placed for.
I'm glad to hear that. So yeah. Let me ask, and I'll start with Matt Merritt, who's on the road with yeah. Roses and Revolutions. Have you found Roses and Revolutions? Most of the time, do you get paid for your work, or do you find yourself more and more feeling like people want things for free?
Oh, a little bit of both. I mean, we've had songs on shows on Showtime, MTV, like VH1, like that kind of stuff, and we've received quite a deal of money through, you know, a little bit of an upfront fee from them, but then also through collecting royalties through we're members of CSAC. But then, like, I mean, just a couple weeks ago, we had a radio show, Bruce Warren of WXBN, he does something called, like, My Morning Download, where he gives a song every morning away for free, and he picked our song. So we gave away Take Me With You for free, and just from that, we were giving away a free song, so we didn't make any money on that, but we saw other songs spike up on iTunes, and we also received like offers from a manager that represents a band that we're really, you know, into, ask us to go on tour. So like it kind of like helped out all avenues. So if it makes sense, you know, we definitely are down to work with people and doing stuff for free. So we've done a little bit of both.
What about Violet Mary, Mike?
We find that the freeness of things tends to happen with live shows more than it does with the recorded material. We keep our overhead so low with recorded material that whether or not we give a song away is, we don't care. That's fine. Please take it, enjoy it, love it. But where we find the economics become an issue are when we try and go play in Buffalo or Ithaca or Erie, PA or something like that, and they want you to come out and play for exposure. Or they want you to come out and a promoter will tell you, we're going to pay you X, Y, and Z, and you get it in writing, and then at the end of the gig, after the work is done, that number magically changes. And as a small artist in a rather large pool of artists, we have no place to go with that. So that's where we find the economics gets weird.
Yeah, but right. The venue where it gets strange is more in her world.
Not Water Street, though.
No, not Water Street, but and, just in live.
Water Street has done very well for us.
And to be really honest, I years ago, I toured with a band. I was a tour manager. And we spent 3 days in a blizzard in Hartford, Connecticut, waiting for the club owner to pay us. Yes, granted, we had a blizzard and you couldn't travel for 24 hours. But we decided our choice to spend our hotel money in that town to try and get that club owner to pay us. Could not do it. Our agent could not do it. The band that was playing 2 days later on a Friday night, I knew him, called the artist up and said, hey, I need a favor. You've got a gig on Friday at this place in Hartford. they haven't paid so-and-so yet. What can you do to help me? He called his manager. An hour later, got a club call from the club owner saying, please come and pick up your money.
Yeah.
Had no idea why. Manager from the other band threatened to cancel the gig.
Do
to
those
help
things
us out.
Still happen?
Oh, they certainly the do. Time. I hear it absolutely. From bands all the time.
Yeah. Not getting paid what you're owed?
Yeah.
I mean, absolutely. It takes money to go after money. Mm-hmm. So if you're owed $500, $1,000, $3,000, I mean, look, to start a simple lawsuit, you're looking at $2,000 or $3,000.
So they're betting that you're just not going to come after them.
Yeah, and what Kat did was exactly what you need to do, is to somehow apply pressure from other people in the industry. So your connections allowed you to get your money. But if you didn't have those connections, you would have been...
No, the band would have suffered financially. And, you know, for a band that makes $500 a night and travels in a van and trailer...
You need every dollar there.
You can't.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and if you're supporting that band that's $500 and you're talking to the booking guy, you don't know what that band's guarantee is. So I could flood the door. I could have 75 people. They bring five because they're on the road and nobody knows who they are. They're going to get my door money for their $500 first before I would ever see anything. And then it might not even cover that, and then you get zero.
This is where I love the internet, because when that happens to you, you're,
see
you're right, absolutely. You're like, you know, we just got hammered by Club X. It's going out to your 1,000 friends. Please pass
absolutely.
It on.
Absolutely.
So, and that's the way it should be.
Yeah. I mean, that's the way you hit back, right, Roy?
Well, it's the inexpensive way to hit back. And, you know, as long as you're telling the truth, you're not opening yourself up to any kinds of repercussions.
And
the truth is the truth.
I mean, do you find people don't value your live performances as much or place as much importance on this as everything else? Because to me, it's all encompassing. It's everything. And honest to God, my finest day as a promoter was when I paid the Campbell Brothers points. I mean, it wasn't much. But the fact that I handed them extra money and they looked at me and said, what is this for? And I said, you went into points, and I explained the whole thing. And they were ecstatic. Sadly, I've not been able to do that again. But do you find that people don't value your live performances because of other things like Spotify or YouTube, because they can see your video online?
That's true. Well, she brought that up in the essay. Yeah. How she's got to step it up each night because they can see the tour every single night. Yeah, I don't know.
Do you guys, the band that's on the road that's going to perform tonight, Matt Merritt, do you feel like Roses and Revolutions is under pressure to throw some curveballs into a live show because people can find your live stuff on YouTube?
I can see why maybe somebody's on tour, because I know like a lot of big artists like that. Oftentimes, I mean, they'll do the same set list like every night of the tour. So I can see how that can be like, you know, criticized. I mean, for us at the level we're at, I mean, it's always the two of us, but often we'll bring in a cello or a different percussionist, and, you know, we're still, you know, we're about ready to put on a whole new batch of songs. So for us, we haven't run into that because you know, there's not as many live videos as us out there, and we're not.
Right.
You
Taylor know, Swift has got people watching her live shows by the millions, and so maybe she does feel the need. So, I think it's a difference of scale here.
Yeah.
A couple points here. On Twitter, David is asking, do you have a song list from today's show? I will mention that... we've got Violet Mary with the Sun. We played that one. And again, as a lover of music, and my family has been in music, and I really appreciate all the people involved with today's show, go out and buy these songs or buy these albums. Violet Mary with the Sun was played. My Plastic Sun, Give It All Away. Roses and Revolutions, Take Me With You. Admirers, Spirit Lamp. And Drew Kayla, Graduation Day. That's on iTunes only. Ra Ra Riot, Shadow Casting. Those are the songs we've been listening to today. And I want to take the conversation in the direction of what a contract is. And I think this is my understanding may have changed, and this is where Roy can maybe help educate me even more here. I remember 20 years ago hearing about a band from Pennsylvania, and they're one of these bands that toured regionally. You'd see them in Cleveland, you'd see them in Pittsburgh. Very solid, but you know, not a national breakthrough. And I remember hearing that they got a $250,000 record contract, and I was blown away. I'm thinking, wow, $250,000. That's like $1 billion to me at the time, right? But two things about that. First of all, my understanding is that a recording contract, and maybe everyone's different, but in general, it's different than, say, an author's book contract. An author gets an advance. You're keeping that money. That's yours, no matter if you don't sell any books. Now, you might not get another contract if you don't sell books, but that's your money. In recording, the story I was told was this band got a $250,000 contract, but it became sort of a noose around their neck. They didn't sell very many records, and they were essentially in debt, or they felt like they had to pay back a lot of the production or promotion or whatever went into it. And I don't know all the details, Roy, but they never got another deal, and they said worst thing they ever did was sign that big contract. What is it? Is that – have you heard those
kinds
of stories?
I mean, there's all kinds of horror stories, and, you know, Mikey can tell you some, I'm sure, from
I still get my
friends.
BMG budget every year about how much I still owe back from my publishing. Yeah, what will I ever get in
recoupable is a bad word,
what
right?
What do you mean you owe? Tell me.
Well, because they gave us so many publishing advances in 2002 and 2004, we've never worked them off. And Longwave is just further and further in the distance. The placements are even less. So, you know, it just goes down every couple of days. I'll get the balance of where I'm at.
But that
before
means
I ever
that
see
technically
the,
you owe the label money?
Yeah.
Yeah, the band does, not you individually.
Yeah, it's a
you
business.
See, right. I mean, they recoup. So you say 250,000. Well, if there's four or five guys in a band,
right,
or people in a band, where's that going? You know, I mean, as far as living off of that, how long are you going to do that? But the 250,000 is mostly for recording costs and marketing. The record company recoups everything from you, and traditionally in the old days. And they recoup it primarily through your CD sales. So you might have to sell a 500,000 CDs because you're only getting about, when they sold CDs for about $12 in the old days, the artist would see about $1 in revenue from those.
Is that right?
So you've got 250,000 CDs to sell before the band sees a penny on that 250,000. So, you know, it took mega hits to make a lot of money. Nowadays, most of the labels are asking for 360 deals. They sign artists, and they want a percentage of your publishing. They want a percentage of your T-shirt sales, all your merchandising. They want a percentage, of course, of your downloads. And they may want a percentage of the actual gate that you take in, you know, whatever your surplus or profit is from your touring. So the labels have actually kind of upped the ante in terms of what they're grabbing from the artist. Labels are still very important to an artist, primarily with radio, which still matters.
You're hearing that that's Roy Stein, who's with My Plastic Son, but also teaches music business at Nazareth. And so maybe you get a little extra muscle for the band in dealing with these questions. But let me just start to close the hour by asking, when it comes to labels, where is My Plastic Son, and you know, what do you expect going forward?
I have no idea. I mean, we had a song that was played constantly on Sirius XM's Coffee House for 6 months, so we had some labels looking at us. We have an open invitation to go down to New York City and showcase for RCA. But the band members aren't really, I would say, aggressively pursuing it the way we should. But, you know, labels aren't a panacea, as, you know, like Mikey was saying. I mean, you know, it's great and it's not great. If you can do things on your own, Taylor Swift's last sentence, I think, was right on. One of my friends manages a very successful touring band I won't mention, but, I mean, they're a huge draw. And he manages a couple other bands, and he said, right now, labels want the bands to do the heavy lifting, you know, before they'll sign you. They want to see fans. They want to see record sales. They want to see a really vibrant social kind of networking going on. And so I see somebody like Roses and Revolution that you're talking to right now on the road. That's exactly what the labels want to see. They want to see bands that are touring, that are working hard, that are out there. And it's weird because it's almost like they come to you at the time you don't need them anymore.
Yeah.
But they're still, if you want to get on Conan, you want to get on David Letterman, you know, labels are huge.
Yeah,
you want to get on radio airplay around the globe.
Or a good
radios
PR company.
A really good PR company. Yeah, yeah, all these things.
You got to get in the creme de la creme of those PR companies.
All right, so let's finish up with Mikey, what's your situation with admirers and your thoughts about labels going forward?
I'm signed to a label right now, Ardent Music in Memphis.
Good relationship?
I'm actually trying to get released. Actually, there's a conference as we speak probably going on about last year they put out a record, but it's weird. I don't know why they signed me. I was kind of doing fine on my own. And it's funny. I can bounce this off you. I got like 12 placements on networks in like 2 years over records I had put out. And you brought up the Atomic Swindlers like 10 years later. Well, it's like my stuff was getting placed like 3 years after. I started getting a bunch of Mercy stuff 2010. Jukebox blew up in 2012.
You're thinking, great, that
and
band
so,
broke up. Thanks a lot.
And then I just sent my rush down to a producer I've been been with for years. He's won a couple of Grammys with the White Stripes and stuff. And they were like, no, you're doing it here. You're going to at least mix it here. And then I went down and mixed a couple, which I paid for, and then it slowly turned into, we want to sign you. And how do you say no to the drummer of Big Star? Hmm. You know what I mean? But they didn't know what they were getting into with me, because I am 37 and I had no band. It's studio pop. I play everything all by myself primarily. And so they didn't want to give a tour budget so I could build a band, which I could probably get a really great band. There's so many good people in Rochester. I mean, I could, I played some live shows with a bunch of guys around here, and it's just good, great, but you got to pay for it. And more than you would if you just had a band, you know? They're mercenaries almost.
Mike, what's the situation with Violet Marion labels?
I think we're in a unique situation compared to the other panelists, because the labels aren't on our horizon. We're not actively looking. We've had a lot of interest outside of Rochester, and continue to get it, but we do everything in-house.
But when they call, you at least listen?
Oh, sure. Sure.
But you're not going to take a deal that isn't really a plum deal for you then?
No. Well, because I don't want to tell my kids that if I don't sell 50,000 records, we have to leave our house.
Right.
To be honest, the economics of art, I don't want to be involved with it. I just want to make it.
Matt Merritt, 20 seconds. Label situation for Roses and Revolutions.
Well, first, I just want to say thanks to Roy for the kind words. We're big fans of what you guys do, too. And right now, I mean, labels, I mean, we kind of, it's not a priority for us. I mean, obviously, if the right deal came along, but it's almost like, you know, if you go after them, you're not going to get the best deal as if you just, you know, really focus on, you know, making good music and trying to get it out there. And if everybody else knows about it, like you said, then labels will come to you. So, I mean, it's not something we've really devoted a lot of time to or been approached with. So.
All right, as we wrap the hour, Matt, where can people find Roses and Revolutions online?
You can find us at rosesandrevolutions.com. We're on Facebook, Twitter, Pandora, Spotify, all that.
Thanks for taking the time. Mikey, where can people find you online?
Admirers. Bandcamp, iTunes, just Google Admirers.
Admirers. Roy, My Plastic Son.
iTunes, MyPlasticSon.com, Facebook.
Mike, Violet Mary.
VioletMary.com or any social media outlet.
And if you haven't been to Water Street Music Hall, they can find a schedule of events, Kat, there.
Yes, WaterStreetMusic.com.
Been a lot of fun and learned a lot from you guys. Great stuff. Thanks. Good luck
to
all of you guys.
Thank you.
And thanks for taking the time. We'll do this again sometime. Really enjoyed our musicians roundtable today. Thanks for listening. Thanks to Mike Black, our engineer. I'm Evan Dawson, and this is member-supported public radio.